Welcome to a special hour-long episode of Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and today I'm joined by an author, comics artist, and longtime editorial cartoonist. He's the creator of the syndicated comic strips Rudy Park and Canderville, as well as the first African-American to be awarded the Pulitzer Prize for editorial cartooning. And he's the author of the graphic memoir, The Talk. Darren Bell, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So Darren, before we talk about The Talk, I want to ask you about your comic Canderville. In one form or another, it's been around since you were a high school journalist, and it still runs in the Daily Californian.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's still in the Daily Cal. It probably is. But yeah, I created it in my senior year of high school back in 1993 as a class project. In AP English, we were supposed to read one book a week and then interpret it artistically, or interpret at least the main themes artistically. And, you know, there were some people who would recite poetry or create a one-act play or one-person play. And I created a comic strip, mostly because I was shy and I didn't want to stand up in front of the class and give weekly reports. But I fell in love with doing the comic strip. And after I graduated, I spent the rest of the summer drawing about 100 of them. And when colleges were calling me to offer me admittance, my only question to them was, how good is your student newspaper? And do you have a cartoonist already? So I ended up going to UC Berkeley because the Daily Californian was the most respected student newspaper outside of the Ivy Leagues. And, you know, I was determined to make a career out of it. And first week of college, there was an advertisement from the Daily Cal for a new journalist. So I went and showed up with, you know, with a manila folder with all my cartoons. And I marched right in and I told them, I'm your new cartoonist. And they started running them a few weeks later.
Yeah, the original title of the strip was Lamont Brown. And the cast of the strip, which became Canderville, it's mainly Latino and African-American. That seems to reflect the neighborhoods you grew up in. If I recall, that's South Central and East L.A.
Right.
So, yeah, the characters. There's Lamont Brown, the writer and artist who bears the slightest resemblance to you. His childhood friend and possible love interest, Susan Garcia. And one of the other main characters is Clyde, who wears a hoodie that says Thug for Life. But this turns out to be a bit of a front, a facade. There's a lot of playing around with language, including some code switching.
Right. There's a lot of it. Yeah. So I've been doing Canderville for most of my life now. And I was 19 when it began. I'm close to 59 now. I mean, 49 now. Yeah, the characters, you know, the main character, Lamont Brown, bears somewhat of a similarity to me, but I've found over the years that I tend to agree with the other characters sometimes more than I do with Lamont, especially Clyde, who, I mean, he's deceptively wise. And it usually takes people. I intended Clyde to be sort of a Rorschach test. Like if you look at him and you actually see a thug, you know, you're only looking one level deep. If you scratch the surface even a little bit, you'll see a philosopher. Clyde can see through all of Lamont's, Lamont is really optimistic about human nature, so he's like constantly disappointed when people fall short. But Clyde can see right through that. He's more of a cynic. So he expects people to fall short of the lofty ideals that Lamont has for them. So, I mean, not only is he not disappointed when they do fall short, but he's sort of reassured that his worldview is correct.
Well, Lamont does try to see the best in everybody. He's not naive. There's one strip where Lamont gets pulled over for driving while black. And when the cop shows up at his window, Lamont has his hands on the wheel and his license and registration scotch taped to his head.
Right. Well, he doesn't want to get shot. You know, he has high ideals, but like you said, he's not naive. He knows that people often fall short, but he always hopes that he'll be proven wrong.
Now, as if one daily comic wasn't hassle enough, you got together with a friend of yours, a fellow Berkeley alum, Matt Richtel, also known as There on Air. And you started a second cartoon called Rudy Park. And that was a very different cast of characters.
It was. Most of them are white, and Rudy Park is set in a suburb, which when I took over the writing duties 10 years later, I made the suburb be a suburb of Canderville, right across the bridge from it. And I named that suburb Canardville. Canard means lie, Canner means truth. I think there might be a little more mean-spiritedness in some of the characters in Rudy Park, and I enjoyed exploring that. Like, the owner of the cafe was a conniving businessman who was basically Quark from Deep Space Nine in the form of a human. And it was just so fun writing all the ways that he was trying to screw his patrons and his one lone employee. And, you know, people often ask me, why would people keep going to a place like this? Well, I had several sequences where I explained why. All the local politicians are in this guy's pocket, and on his behalf, they've zoned the place so that there can't be any competitors. And buying coffee beans to brew coffee at home is just way too expensive. So they have no choice but to go to his cafe. It's the only cafe for 50 miles around.
You were doing Rudy Park with your friend Theron, and then you took it over and you were doing the writing as well as the art. And that was a bit much. I mean, you're doing two daily strips, you're doing editorial cartooning. And so Rudy Park still shows up sometimes on Counterpoint Media, but you've really decided to focus on Canderville. And sometimes the Rudy Park characters show up in Canderville.
They do. Well, Matt wrote Rudy Park from 1997 until 2012. And he left because, you know, he was working for the New York Times. He was a Pulitzer Prize winning columnist. He also started writing mystery and thriller novels, so he didn't have time to continue writing Rudy Park. So I took it over, and I kept it going from 2012 to 2018. And I loved working with Matt all those years. And I'll just add that after 2012, I felt like Rudy Park was suddenly a playground that was all my own. And I got to implement every idea that I had suggested to Matt that he had rejected over the previous decade. I got to do it. And, you know, I couldn't have been happier to do it. Because I love those characters. But in 2018, after I had bought a house and, you know, was struggling to pay the bills, I just realized it was too much work. Because I was sleeping maybe 3 or 4 hours a night. And I had two small kids at the time. So they took so much energy out of me. And then at night I would try to do my work and I would just fall asleep on my iPad, and something had to give. So I called my editor and I asked which newspapers exactly were running Rudy Park and which were running Canderville. And it turned out there was only one newspaper that was running both. So I suggested that we just merge the strips and, you know, continue to call it Rudy Park in the papers that were running Rudy, continue to call it Canderville and the rest. And that worked for a while. You know, I got to include the Rudy Park characters whenever it made sense. And I got to write a really fun storyline to merge the strips. It turned out that Armstrong, to supplement his income, Armstrong was the conniving owner of the cafe. he had been selling fracking rights beneath the entire town that he didn't really own, but they used the basement of the cafe as their base, and they would do all their drilling sideways from there underground. And so the entire city of Kennardville ended up collapsing into a huge sinkhole. And the survivors had to immigrate across the bridge to Canderville. And Donald Trump was president at the time, so there was a huge refugee thing. They were all put in pens and separated from their loved ones. And eventually they got out and they were able to be in Canderville. And they started over there with the new cafe. And yeah, they're still there. But this was possible because both strips were with the same syndicate.
Well, you mentioned politics making its way into the comic strips, so sometimes they end up on the editorial page. And you're talking about, a lot happening in 2018. Well, in 2019, as we mentioned earlier, you became the first African American to receive the Pulitzer Prize for editorial cartooning. And the judges praised your work, and I'm going to quote here, for beautiful and daring editorial cartoons that took on issues affecting disenfranchised communities, calling out lies, hypocrisy, and fraud in the political turmoil surrounding the Trump administration. Unquote.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's funny because I wasn't supposed to be drawing editorial cartoons at all. In 2001, I had been a freelance editorial cartoonist for about 6 years, and I retired from editorial cartooning sometime after 9/11 so I could focus on my comic strips on getting Rudy Park and Canderville into newspapers. But, the whole time my syndicate, the Washington Post Writers Group, was asking me to resume editorial cartooning because they wanted to distribute that work to newspapers, and I kept saying no. But then, 10 years later, George Zimmerman murdered Trayvon Martin. And I wrote a week of comic strips about that in Canderville, where my main character, who's often done this, he accompanied somebody to the afterlife. This time he accompanied Trayvon Martin on his ride to the afterlife. And I said a lot in that week. And, there was a lot of praise for that week. I was interviewed by the Post and a bunch of other places about that week that I had written. But the whole time I was thinking, I have not even scratched the surface of what I wanted to say about this. I've said all I could say on the comics page. So I called up my editor and I said, "You know how you've been wanting me to get back into editorial cartooning?" I said, "Well, I'm in." And so the first cartoon I drew was about this situation. And I was determined to cover every similar situation over the next few years. And I had no idea how many cartoons I was going to have to draw about that. It was dozens, if, because the very next year, that's when people started videotaping all these murders of unarmed black people. And I would cover each one. It almost, I felt like it was, if I didn't do it, who was going to do it? And I was the only black editorial cartoonist that I knew of in American newspapers. I felt I had a responsibility to do it. So I spent, and it's still happening. It was so shocking at the time. And I think the shock has worn off and people are normalizing it and not talking about it much anymore, but it's still happening. And I'm still drawing cartoons about it. And I ended up winning the Robert F. Kennedy Award, mostly for cartoons dealing with this issue, also for cartoons dealing with equal marriage rights for gay people. When I won the Pulitzer a few years later, I won it for cartoons that mostly covered the Donald Trump administration. And one reporter asked me, he'd apparently been following my work from the beginning. He said, "You put so much time and energy and effort and passion into covering the killing and the brutality against unarmed black people, but here you won the Pulitzer for something else entirely." He said, Does that hurt? Is it like people don't care about what you really care about, and they only care about this issue?" And my answer was no, it doesn't. The persecution and killing of of black people who don't have to be killed is a function of white supremacy. Donald Trump being elected right after the very first black president, there's a huge backlash, and they elected the least qualified, most repugnant, and most narcissistic individual in history because, not in spite of, but because they recognized he was a white supremacist. It's all part of the same movement. What I got back into cartooning to cover and the Donald Trump administration, it's all part of the same movement. So, no, it didn't hurt me that I won the Pulitzer for covering Trump. Like I said, it was all fruit from the same poisonous tree.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And today we're talking with author and comics artist Darren Bell. He's the creator of the syndicated comic strips Rudy Park and Canderville, and the author of the graphic memoir The Talk. Before we get back to the conversation, I'd like to take a moment to remind our listeners that KBOO is in the last week of our All Thrills, No Frills membership drive. We hope that you've been enjoying our programming and that you'll take a moment to pledge your support. There are all kinds of ways to join KBOO. On the web, you can visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. And if you prefer to go analog, we're always happy to receive a contribution in the mail. The address of the station is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And now let's talk some more with our guest, Darren Bell. I want to talk about your book, your graphic memoir, The Talk. In chapter one of this book, you tell your mom that you really want a water pistol. You're what, 5, 6 years old? She's
Six.
6 years old. She's reluctant to give you a water pistol. And when she finally does it looks nothing like a real gun. It's bright green.
Right. And transparent. You could see, I remember holding it up to my eyes. You could see my eyes through it. So, I was upset. I was grateful I finally had a water gun, but I was upset that it didn't look like a real pistol, like all the other kids' water guns did. I was sure I was gonna be made fun of because of it. And I asked her why. And that's when she gave me the talk. And it went in one ear and out the other because it didn't make any sense to me. I thought she was just covering for the fact that she probably had gone to the thrift store or the 99-cent store and bought me the cheapest thing she could find. I thought she was trying to rationalize that. And in my 6-year-old head, that's what I thought. And so, as soon as she wasn't looking, I snuck out and I went through the neighborhood on the same path that I would always go to my bus stop. And I was shooting everything in sight. And I'd gone through that path, so I know that everybody who saw me knew who I was and they recognized me. But still, somebody, in retrospect, somebody must have called 911, because when I got near my destination, I stooped down to refill the water gun in a puddle, and that's when I heard somebody say, "Drop the weapon." And I looked up, and it was a police officer who's towering over me. I mean, he must have been around 6 feet, but at the time he looked like a giant. He looked, like 20 feet tall. And at first I thought he was playing with me, because I had seen police play with little white kids, stick 'em up playing cops and robbers and stuff. And I thought, that's what's happening here. But the look of fury on his face and the fact that and just the tension in his stance and how he was barking orders at me told me that this was not a game. This was serious. And I froze. And I just knelt down and I closed my eyes and wished he would go away. And after a few more barked orders, I heard him walk over toward me, and I could tell he was picking up my water gun, which I had dropped in the puddle. And then he got in his car and he drove away. And only then did I open my eyes, you know, literally and figuratively. You know, I thought back to what my mom had just tried to tell me. And one of the things she had just told me in the talk she gave me was that she bought that bright green, ridiculous looking water gun because it was going to save my life. She said, "The world is different for me and my brother than it is for my little white friends." She said, "You know, if a police officer saw or someone else saw them playing with guns, they would assume that those are toys. And they would see them as innocent little kids playing. But if they saw me with a realistic looking gun, they would think I was a thug and that I was a threat. And something bad might happen to me. I might not come home." And I realized my mom was right. And so that was a really long walk home. You know, it was maybe 5 blocks, but it felt like I was walking for an eternity, and I didn't tell anybody about what happened for years.
Which is crazy. You're 6 years old. You've just had this traumatic experience, and you don't tell either of your parents.
I knew my dad wouldn't want to hear anything about that, and I thought I would get in trouble. I thought if he heard that I had snuck out and provoked the police, that I'd probably get a beating. You know, I'd probably get a spanking. I didn't want that. And my mom, I thought if I had told her, she'd probably never let me out of her sight again, and I'd never be able to go out and play. So I kept it to myself. Plus, I felt a lot of shame about my reaction to that police officer. Because when you're a little kid, you don't really see yourself as being as small as you are. And, you know, I thought I was a person. I was like my own son thinks he knows everything. I thought I should have been able to handle anything. And yet I froze. I didn't say one word to that cop. You know, I even let him take my gun. And I thought, there's no way I should have done that. So I kept it to myself. And I didn't tell anyone until a couple of years later. I told a friend in school after another incident happened, and his reaction made me think I definitely should not ever talk about this. He acted like I had just told him the earth was flat. He said, "Police don't do that sort of thing." I mean, this friend obviously wasn't black. You know, he said, "The police are there to help." And he said, "You must have misinterpreted the thing. You know, it didn't happen." And that's when I realized that people are not going to believe you if they haven't gone through it themselves. And so I should just shut up about it and you know, suppress it, which I did, you know, until Trayvon Martin got killed and until Tamir Rice was killed. That's when I started talking about it again, because I realized I could have been Tamir Rice. If I had been turned a little bit farther away from the sun and that gun had been in a shadow and it would have looked darker, the police officer might have just shot me like they did Tamir Rice as soon as he got out of his car.
Oh, man. Well, your parents were both teachers in the Los Angeles Unified School District.
Right.
Your dad taught at a school where the so-called problem kids were sent rather than being sent to juvenile hall.
Well, it wasn't the entire school. It was just his class.
Oh, just his class. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, well, there were problem kids at the school, but you know, it was a typical Los Angeles school. It wasn't like overrun with gangs, but teachers from surrounding neighborhoods that were overrun with gangs would sometimes send their kids to him. Like I don't really know how this worked, because he's not around anymore for me to ask. But you know, they would get to go to his class every day instead of going to juvenile hall. And after he passed away, I asked, you know, people who knew him well at the time what kind of teacher he was. And it conformed with the memory I had of the one time he took me to one of his classes. He was really stern with the kids, but he also had this really disarming sense of humor. And he would listen to them, and then he would say something. This was like, I guess this was like a technique of his. He would say something that totally unexpected that would make them laugh. These like really tough people would laugh, and they'd find themselves laughing. And then he would be honest and candid with them and tell them what they're doing wrong. And they really respected him for how he dealt with them. He didn't talk down to them at all. He treated them with respect, and he gave them really valuable advice. And I thought to myself, this is not really the dad I see at home. But that's who he was at work and with other people. With me, not so much. By the time he got home, I think after and I don't think I gave him much grace or much understanding when I was growing up. I would just like tally up all the ways he was failing me. But after he passed away, I thought, and once I was writing the talk and I had to think about the motivations of all the characters, including my father, it dawned on me that you can't be at the top of your game for 24 hours a day. You have to have downtime. And when he came home, that was his downtime. He didn't want to do the same stuff he had just been doing, all day long, all week long. He just wanted to turn on the TV and tune out. And I was a little kid, and I wish things had been different. I wish he had saved some of that for me, but he didn't. He was like an athlete who left it all out on the field, and then when he got home, just wanted to recuperate.
I should point out that your dad was black, your mom was white, and as I said, they were both teachers. As a kid, you were pretty much the polar opposite of the students that your dad dealt with. You were a good kid. You were curious. You were quick-witted. You were diligent. Any normal teacher would have been delighted to have you in their class. But as we find out in the book, in the talk, not all of your teachers were normal teachers.
No, I mean, see, it doesn't just come from the police. It comes from all walks of life. Anyone who's in a position of authority is just a person who's bringing their preconceived notions with them. And when I was in class, I tested into the Gifted and Talented program, and I ended up going to Wonderland Avenue University, which is up in the Hollywood Hills. And my classmates were the children of actors. Some of them were actors themselves. They were the children of lawyers and newscasters, meteorologists, all these, like, at the time, what I thought were really fancy and really rich and ambitious careers. And the teachers always encouraged us to question them and to, think for ourselves. And they seemed to really love it when those kids did it. But when I did it, they didn't react exactly the same. I mean, a couple of them really did. A couple of them were great. Mrs. Drake, Mrs. Cass, but the others, I would be called a troublemaker for questioning something a teacher said. There's an incident that I describe in the book that really stuck with me because I knew the teacher was dead wrong in what she was saying. Like she asked us to name something in our everyday life that we use every day that relies on electricity. We went around the room doing that. And when it got to me, I said a car. And she said, no, a car is mechanical. It doesn't rely on electricity. So I said, well, why does it have a battery? And she said, well, that's just for the radio. The car doesn't need the radio to run, so it doesn't rely on electricity. And then she called on somebody else. And ordinarily, I would have just sat down, and even though I knew I was right, I would have just sat down and let it go. But I was the only one she had been telling that I was wrong. That like she didn't argue with any of the other people. And Also, this was the first time I had raised my hand in a while because my parents had just had gotten a divorce, and I was like really keeping to myself and not participating much in class. So here I was putting myself out there, which was really hard for me, and I was getting smacked down. So I didn't sit down. I raised my hand again and I spoke, and she looked at me like I had just slapped her by doing that. And I said, "What about the spark plugs? The sparks are electricity. The car can't start without the spark plugs. So it does rely on electricity." And that's when she said, "See me after class. We're going to have to talk about your attitude."
Yeah, there's a sequence in chapter three of the talk where your mom really goes after a couple of your grade school teachers, just rips into them for what she sees as their bias. And she was using her privilege as a white person and as a veteran teacher herself. At the time, though, you still felt embarrassed.
Oh God, I was humiliated. I thought this woman was ruining my life. You know, like I said, when you're a kid, you think you should be able to handle all these things yourself. So I always told my mom, "I've got it covered, Mom. You know, I let me handle it myself." But no, she would. And this was the detail, the incident I put in the talk was not the only time she went to my school. It was just the funniest time because she didn't even bother changing out of her robe and slippers, and she still had curlers in her hair. And she marched in there like she owned the place because, I mean, that's the attitude she got to have. You know, she is white, so, you know, she wasn't hauled out of there in handcuffs. You know, like she might have been if she was black. You know, they did talk down to her because she's a woman and women have to go through their own unique struggle. But she just is not the type of person to stand for that because she had the facts on her side. She was a teacher with the LAUSD just like them. She knew what they were supposed to do, how they were supposed to handle a student who didn't turn in his homework. I didn't expect them to fail me for it, and neither did my mom. And she walked in and she demanded to see all their records. And I was sitting outside the room listening, and my friends started to gather around me and they started listening. They said, "Is that your mom in there yelling at Mrs. So-and-so?" And I said, "No, I don't know who that person is." And as soon as I said, "I don't know who that person is," she opened the door and grabbed me by the hand and said, "Come on, Darren, we're going home." I never lived that down. But, you know, to this day, it's at the point that felt like the worst moment in my life. But today, it's one of my favorite memories.
You're listening to a special hour-long episode of Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and today we're talking with author and comics artist Darren Bell. He's the creator of the syndicated comic strips Rudy Park and Canderville, and the author of the graphic memoir The Talk. Before we get back to the conversation, I'd like to take a moment to remind our listeners that KBOO is in the last week of our All Thrills, No Frills membership drive. We hope that you've been enjoying our programming and that you'll take a moment to pledge your support. KBOO is one of the very last media outlets that still brings you local and independent news, music, and public affairs. We've been doing this here in Portland for over half a century, and this program has been coming to you for 20 years now, inviting important cultural figures into the studio and venturing out to events that might fly beneath the radar of the big media monoliths. So, yes, you can support this very special programming today by going online to kboo.fm/give or simply text KBOO to 44321. And if you prefer to go analog, we're always happy to receive a contribution in the mail. The address of the station is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And now let's talk some more with our guest, Darren Bell. So your mom, in addition to being a teacher, she was a talented artist. And she was the one who provided you originally with drawing materials, and she schooled you in technique.
Yeah, when I was three, she discovered something that made my father furious, but that made her delighted. She discovered that I had drawn this really intricate mural on the inside of my closet. And so my dad was upset that the landlady might see it, because we had this awful landlady who would show up every once in a while for surprise inspections. And, you know, in retrospect, I realized, you know, what was motivating this landlady. But at the time, I thought, this is just how renting is. It's like living in a police state. So he thought she was going to show up and see this, and we were going to get evicted. They ended up painting over it, but my mom bought me art supplies, and she taught me everything she knew. She taught me about perspective, about shading, about light sources, about all that stuff. And she started taking me to college with her. She was a student at Cal State LA, and she was studying child development, but she also took some art classes, and she took me to those. And I sat there on a blanket, you know, with my toys and my drawing supplies, painting and drawing along with people in their 20s and 30s. I've been asked many times, did you go to school for art? And I always say, yeah. But what I'm thinking about is what happened when I was three.
And for those people who think that's amazing, your folks subscribed to the Los Angeles Times starting when you were very young. And that paper is where you were first introduced to editorial cartoons. At the tender age of, what, 5, 6 years old, you became a fan of the legendary Paul Conrad.
Yeah, before I knew, you know, before I had any political ideology of my own or any opinions at all about politics, I was crazy about Paul Conrad's artwork. He could somehow create an ocean that would make you feel like you're being drenched in water out of just scratches of black and white. You know, at the time, that's what editorial cartoons were. They were all India ink, and something else that I'm still not sure what he used. It was probably some kind of chalk or some kind of crayon, but he would create these magnificent textures, and I would just stare at them for what seemed like forever. I'd get lost in them. And, you know, my father would read them and he'd laugh. And after a while I started looking at the comics page, and my father and I would read the comic strips together. We weren't very close, but we spent a lot of time going over this satire together in the newspaper and also on TV. We would watch all the Norman Lear shows. And I just loved seeing my father, who was this really stern person, just laughed like a little kid when he was reading Drabble or Plume County or watching Archie Bunker on TV. And that's when I realized that that's what I want to do when I grow up. I think ever since then, I've been happy that I get to do something that I know would make my dad laugh.
And you went straight on from there. You sold editorial cartoons to the LA Times and the San Francisco Chronicle while you were still in college.
Yeah. You know, I had a plan. You know, I was going to be the official editorial cartoonist of the Daily Californian. And as soon as I got that, I created a letterhead. And I, at the time, there was no email. So I would come in late at night to the paper and use their fax machine. And I would take whatever cartoon I had just drawn for the Daily Cal, and I would write a cover letter saying, I'm Darren Bell, I'm the staff cartoonist for the Daily Californian. And I was thinking, there must be people at these newsrooms who had gone to Berkeley or had gone to some other university and would be impressed by a college student trying to parlay working at a student newspaper into something else. I thought it would remind them of themselves, because I'm sure that that's the journey that they took. And I was right. You know, so they started running my work not the LA Times, but the San Francisco Chronicle and the Oakland Tribune started running my work pretty soon after I started sending it to them. The Los Angeles Times, I faxed them a cartoon almost every day for a year. And finally, they called me up and they said, if we assign you a cartoon every other week, would you please stop faxing us? And they told me I should get a cell phone, which at the time was nobody on campus had a cell phone. If you saw somebody walking around with a cell phone, you assume they were a drug dealer because they were rare. So I had a cell phone at the age of 19, and I was getting calls from the LA Times with topics of things they wanted me to draw about, and I was on top of the world.
Now, hate mail goes with the territory when you're a political cartoonist, but it could get more disturbing for you than for some of your colleagues.
It could. I mean, when I was in college, though, it was exciting. I mean, I don't think they knew I was black, and race didn't really come into it. I had drawn this cartoon about the Pope's visit to Mexico, which was being sponsored by major corporations. So I drew a cartoon where the Pope was sitting on a chair, and he had all these like corporate decals on him, like he was a NASCAR vehicle, and his hat said Popesy on it with the Pepsi sign. And I was proud of that. To this day, I'm proud of that cartoon. I loved it. But a few days later, I was called into the Daily Cal, and as soon as I walked in, my opinion page editor, Matt Bellany, who's now, I forget what show he's working for, Inside Hollywood or something like that. Anyway, as soon as I walked in, he seemed like he wanted to high five me. He said, come over to my desk. And he opened his desk, and there were thousands of letters, hate mail from people saying that I was sacrilegious, that I was attacking Christianity, and blah, blah, blah. And the first thing I noticed was they were almost word for word identical. And I figured, this was a Monday. They must have gone to some mass at a local church, and they told them exactly what to write. So we were inundated with hate mail. So that kind of thing was fun. But over the years, things started getting a lot worse, especially after I started drawing cartoons about the police killing unarmed black people. The hate mail became a lot more racial. I had gone decades without being called the N-word, but as soon as I said black people shouldn't be gunned down like dogs, the N-word just started flooding my inbox. And peppered in with all that would increasingly be threats, like implied threats. People know what to write. I think people assume that if they don't come right out and say, I am going to kill you, then they're not going to be arrested. But they feel like they can write things like, you should die, or something horrible should happen to you, or you're lucky that you don't live in my city, things like that. But I mean, I don't let it stop me from saying what needs to be said. I mean, we're all going to die sometime. And what I tell myself is it's probably better to go out because you're saying what needs to be said than to be hit by a bus by accident. So you can't live your life in fear.
You took a long break from editorial cartooning starting in 2001, and you mentioned the reasons in the talk, scheduling, exhaustion, that sort of thing. But also, a lot had to do with the September 11th cartoon you drew and the reaction that it got.
I drew a cartoon on September 11th, like late at night, right after they said that the person responsible was someone named Osama bin Laden. And they started showing his picture, and he was wearing a turban, had a long beard, and he was wearing robes. And we didn't know what the hijackers looked like yet. They didn't release that video until a couple days later. But, deadlines being what they are, I wanted to get a cartoon in that day. That was important to me because I knew newspapers were going to be looking for it that night or the next morning. So I drew two hijackers burning in hell, and both of them were drawn to look like Osama bin Laden. And we found out a couple days later that the hijackers, of course, were dressed in regular street clothes, like American street clothes, and were like clean cut and easy to mistake for anybody else. So by the time a lot of people saw the cartoon, they did not understand why I drew somebody in traditional clothes when the hijackers were dressed the way they were. They thought the reason for that must have been Islamophobia. And I could understand that reaction because a lot of people didn't see the cartoon until after they already knew what the hijackers looked like. And that's something that I should have taken into account when I drew that first cartoon that night. We're probably going to know more about these hijackers by the time this sees print. We're probably going to know what they look like. So maybe I should not draw them yet. So yeah, that was a huge mistake, but I understood the reaction from like people like the Students for Justice in Palestine that organized a huge protest on the Daily Cal campus. They like shut down Lower Sproul Plaza. They occupied the Daily Cal offices for days. They demanded that the paper fire me, and the paper refused. And eventually the protest was broken up. I felt bad about, I felt like I had failed personally as a cartoonist, but I was also offended by the newspaper industry for a different reason, a less important reason, but it was still a reason that bothered me as a freelance cartoonist who was struggling to pay the bills. This cartoon was published in hundreds of newspapers. It was on television. It was published internationally. And I wasn't paid a dime for it. And that was because the papers realized that they could cover the cartoon as a news item and use it for free and not have to pay me. And I was told this by one newspaper when I called them and I said, you ran my cartoon on your opinion page. Are you going to pay me for it? And they said, no, kid. It's news. And that really left a bad taste in my mouth. So, and at the same time, my comic strips were taking off, and I thought, I think I'll just focus on that because, this whole thing sucks. And it was a decade before I was willing to get back into editorial cartooning. But I still expect that papers operate the same way. If a cartoon I draw tomorrow becomes news, I know they're all going to run it and not pay my syndicate or me a dime for it.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Counser. And today we're talking with author and comics artist Darren Bell. He's the creator of the syndicated comic strips Rudy Park and Canderville, and the author of the graphic memoir The Talk. Before we get back to the conversation, I'd like to take a moment to remind our listeners that KBOO is in the last week of our All Thrills, No Frills membership drive. We hope that you've been enjoying our programming and that you'll take a moment to pledge your support. There are all kinds of ways to join KBOO. On the web, you can visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. And if you prefer to go analog, we're always happy to receive a contribution in the mail. The address of the station is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And now let's talk some more with our guest, Darren Bell. Even your own brother, your older brother, would negate some of your own experiences about being profiled.
Well, that's one reason in so much of my work I explore the concept of gaslighting. 'Cause I was getting it not only from my friend at school who I had told about the incident, but from my own brother. Whenever, incidents like that would happen, he would insist that I was misinterpreting it. When I would tell him about how the teachers were treating me, he seemed to think that, it was mostly in my head because the teachers just don't act like that. And that, you know, he, even though he experienced a little bit of that, he didn't experience as much as I did. And I think it's, you know, it's because he was lighter skinned than I was, and he chose to ignore a lot of it, like my father used to do, and pretend it wasn't happening. And the times when he would admit that he was being discriminated against, he would say, "It's not racial. It's not racial." He would refuse to admit it's racial. He would say it's because we're poor. And that used to be so frustrating to me. But as I was writing the book, I realized, yeah, and I was having to explore the motivations of the characters I had, I realized that he and my father were doing something understandable. They were choosing to see the world in a way that was more empowering to them. Like if you're being held back and people are placing obstacles in your way or sabotaging your progress because you're black, well, that's something you can't change. But if they're doing it because you're poor, you could change that just by getting a good job. You know, your fate is entirely in your hands if that's the case. So that's what they chose to believe.
So, towards the end of the talk, you are a dad. You're a fairly new dad, and you've got a toddler son, and you're put in the position of explaining what you do. And you say, "Son, sometimes grown-ups are not nice, and that's why Papa draws a cartoon." And your toddler son replies, "And then they're nice."
Yeah, this conversation happened, and it's something I've had to come to terms with over the last 20 years, because I started my career when I was in my early 20s and idealistic, and I thought I could change the world with logic and reasoning and great imagery, and all I had to do was reach out to people like Barack Obama later on would try to do, and they would engage in an honest conversation, and maybe it would be a productive one, and things could change. And the older I got, the more I realized that a lot of people are not honest at all and don't have any intention of becoming honest. A lot of people have their preconceived notions, and their identity is all wrapped up in them being right and you being wrong. And they get angry. You know, they don't feel enlightened or interested or intrigued or have any warm and friendly feelings toward you if you prove them wrong. They hate you for doing it. So I had to come to terms with the fact that I'm not going to change the world, except, you know, by inches here and there. I might draw something that some well-meaning person, an open-minded person, might someday see and become introspective and think more about what effect they have on the world with their actions. And I, you know, I've been approached by a lot of people who said that happened because they read my cartoons in their formative years, which makes me feel really old, but that's great. But, you know, I'm not going to single-handedly change the world. It takes millions of people to reach millions of people. It doesn't take one person and his artwork to reach millions. I could reach hundreds, maybe thousands. And maybe some of those people will become artists who in turn will reach hundreds or thousands and so on. That's why positive change takes so long. You know, I'll paraphrase somebody, I don't know who said this, but they said that positive change happens incrementally until it happens all at once. So it's like you have to build up critical mass and then everything changes. And it seems like it happened overnight, but it took so many people and so many decades. And all I could do is be part of that. Can't do it on my own. So when my son asked me, "Do my cartoons make people nice?" You know, I didn't want to answer him because he was really tiny at the time. So I changed the subject. I don't want him to grow up being fatalistic and thinking that what we do is futile. But no, my stuff doesn't change the world. All I can do is write what I think and hope that it reaches somebody someday, and maybe those people will change the world.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and my guest today has been Darren Bell. He's the creator of the syndicated comic strips Rudy Park and Canderville, the recipient of the 2019 Pulitzer Prize for editorial cartooning, and the author of the graphic memoir, The Talk. Darren, it's been fantastic talking with you today.
I had a great time too. Thank you.
So what's next for you?
Well, I'm working on a companion book / prequel / sequel to The Talk. It's actually the first book that I sold until we decided to put that on the back burner and do The Talk instead. It's a graphic memoir about my grandfather, my father, and me. Three generations of men descended from slavery. And I'm also working on another graphic novel that I sold to Penguin Random House, which is aimed at the middle grade audience. It's about a shy little kid from the wrong side of the tracks who's new at school.
And for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about your work, where would they look?
They should follow me on Substack at darrenbell.com. That takes them to my Substack newsletter. Or on Patreon at patreon.com/darrenbell. Yeah, those are the best places to follow me.
Well, we hope that everybody has been enjoying this special hour-long episode of Words and Pictures for KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills membership drive. Before we go, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that this community radio station needs your support. To become a member of KBOO or to arrange for a donation of any size, please visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. Or if you prefer, you can mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of the show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.